Namaste. Hello, everyone. Okay. So we start with our usual. We'll start with the Itipi So chant. Some of the bhikkhus have joined us, which is lovely. Good voices. So if you get your sheets out, we'll chant that together three times.
Itipi so bhagava araham samma sambuddho vicca charana sampanno asugato lokavido anuttaro apurisa dhamma sarati sata deva manu sanam bhuto bhagavati sava Katoa bhagavata dhammo santetiko akaliko ehi pasiko opanaiko pacha vedita boa venyu hitis patipanno bhagavato Savaka sankhoa ucu patipannoa bhagavatoa Savaka sankho nyaya patipannoa bhagavatoa Savaka sankho samichi patipannoa bhagavatoa Savaka sankho Yadi dancha tari purisa yugani ata purisa pugala esa bhagavato asavaka sangho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo anjali karaniyo anuttara Punya ketang lokasati tipiso bhagava arahang sama sambuddho vicca charana sampanno asugato allokavido anuttaro Purisa dhamma sarati sata deva manusana buddho bhagavati savakatoa bhagavata dhammo santetiko akalikoa ehi pasikoa opanaiko Pachatang vedita boa venyu hitis patipannoa bhagavato Savaka sankhoa ucu patipannoa bhagavato Savaka sankho nyaya patipannoa bhagavato Savaka sankho samichi patipannoa bhagavato Savaka sankho yadi dancha tari purisa yuga niyata purisa pukkala esa bhagavato Savaka sankho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo anjali karaniyo anuttaram punya ketam lokasati tipiso bhagava arahang samma sambuddho vicca charana sampanno asugato lokavido anuttaro apurisa dhamma sarati sata deva manusanam buddho bhagavati savakkhato bhagavata dhammo asantetiko akaliko Ehi basikoa opanaikoa bachata uedita boa venio hete subati panoa bhagavato sawaka sangkoa ujubati panoa bhagavato sawaka sangkoa nyaya pati panoa bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅkhoa Sāmeche Patipannoa Bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅkhoa Yadidāṃ Chātāre Purisa Yugāni Ta Purisa Pukkala Esa Bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅkhoa Ahuneyo Apahuneyo Dakineyo Anjali Karaniyo Anutta Punyaketam Lokasati.
Right here, let's do some meditation. I'll set the clock for 45 minutes. I won't say much, and let's just use the silence. Enjoy the silence. Sit for 45 minutes. Vivian, is the sound okay? Okay, thank
you. Good.
Sounds good, great. Very good. introduce, it's Monday, Lynn. Lynn, will you do the honors? There she is.
Brahma chaloka dipati saham pati katanjali anadivaram naya chata santida sata parajakajatika dese tu dhammam anukampimam pajam.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. I have received lots of questions, which is very compassionate of you. So that helps me a lot. I'll try to craft something around that. So one of the questions was around study, and do I teach the suttas? Well, I don't. I don't have the gifts of scholarship or language, and so I'm not very good at that. I forget a lot. But so somewhere online you'll find, I'm sure, the structures. But the book that Lompo Sumedho always recommended to us, I got out of the library here. It's a wee small book, show and tell. It's called The Word of the Buddha, and it's by Jnanatiloka Mahatera, and Buddhist Publication Society puts it out, and Pariyatti Press, I think, is Buddhist Publication Society in North America, Pariyatti, The Word of the Buddha. And it's a compilation of references to the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path. So it has little Pali stanzas describing all of that, and also has some commentary. And the commentary is in italics, and the texts of the suttas are in normal print. And I was always told by my first teacher, be careful of the commentaries. So I just look at the translations. And so in terms of study, if you use I think the way I've been trained is use the Four Noble Truths as your backbone, and then around all the different aspects in the Noble Eightfold Path and the three truths and the fourth truth, you can expand it as much as you want. So right understanding, you can look at different aspects of it and really figure that out, and then get your head around that. And that's very, very helpful. I find people sometimes who are in Buddhism but haven't really done the formal practice, I can see them they get confused between psychology, mystical Christianity, Rumi, the Tibetan Buddhism, because they have this kind of whole overlay of very good ideas, but they sometimes don't have a consistent intellectual framework and consistent use of language. So they sometimes fall into doubts because, you know, they're using different paradigms and they're kind of coming together, and that's just the way it is. So like the word emptiness, I think, is used different in Mahayana than it is in Theravada. And yet, you know, you read a text, you know, emptiness, that must mean the same thing. So there is value in kind of figuring out what the Theravada terminology is, not as a kind of fundamentalism, by no means. All those teachers are wonderful. But rather, so you know what the model is about. You have a intellectual clarity. So for me, that occurred in India. I had a really transformative year in India between 1971 and 2, where I came across Krishnamurti, and that was that opened my mind to experiences I had as a child. And a month later, I met a bhikkhu, Bhikkhu Jnanasuchi, and he was very, very smart guy, really good head and a good memory for the suttas. And he walked me through things like paticca-samuppada, dependent origination, and really got my intellect working in ways which are very difficult because it was a bit addled from Afghanistan. So I had to kind of get it going again. we won't go there. Anyway, so from his instruction and his inspiration that I eventually determined to become a monk. And he was very rigorous about language and the use of language and the particular language that Theravada uses. So if you want to study, certainly do that. But don't see study as something which is, it's not encyclopedic study. It's not the endless accumulation of more knowledge, because I found if I went that trail, it just got me into more doubt. But a kind of, like I use the word the project, a Buddhist project, to get all the, why does the Buddha talk about this and that, and how does it fit to the whole project, really helps with intellectual doubt. You still have, self-doubt as an emotional quality, but getting your head around this is very, very helpful. So he was good. He was really excellent. And I kind of took me a lot to kind of get my head around the whole thing. But again, I don't have a good memory, really. And I had an interesting incident with Lompo Sumedho, who was here recently, and someone from the audience asked him, what does Sangvega, one of these Pali words, what does that mean? It's a very common word. And he said, I don't know. And then he looked at me, I said, yeah, I forget too. So these two old monks, right? And so somehow when you're a young monk, you kind of get all the language down, but then you start, unless you have a really good memory, you start to really understand the project and the need for that kind of analytical not the structure, but the need for analysis, I would say, falls away because you understand. You've done the analysis. There's still a hell of a lot of work to do. That's just the sort of beginning. But you kind of, you understand the project. And so for me, my own, those early years were lots of study. And then I had the good fortune to actually live very close to Ajahn Sumedho for 5 or 6 years, taking care of him and just hearing his teaching all the time. So I think I'm more educated through the oral tradition rather than through the scriptural tradition. But I did have that basis of the Four Noble Truths and the intellectual structures around that. And most monks are speaking through that, although they might, you might not know that. But usually Theravada monk's reference points are those structures. And then maybe he's trying to pitch it in language, which is contemporary. And maybe you're not, you might not be using the Pali words, but if you have that background in those structures, then I see where he's going with this. And then for myself, I try to use different language because I think sometimes people, you use a word and say, oh, I know what that means because you've heard it so many times, but then it's not reflective. And the idea of the teachings are that they're reflective. So the model that is very good to consider is that when you are like going out on the town, whenever anyone's allowed to go out on the town again, and you want to get dressed up, you look in the mirror, see if you got your blouse looks good, or your suit, your tie, whatever. I think my little outfit here. And you look at a mirror, and the mirror shows you what you look like and you kind of tidy up or whatever. And this, in the same way, the teachings are, they're a kind of reflective vehicle, a mirroring, a kind of mirror that helps you see what you're doing in terms of your spiritual practice and what the Buddha is suggesting. And where Buddhism really fails, or any spiritual tradition fails, is when it becomes a kind of fundamental belief system. And that's a kind of superstition, really. And there's a lot of pain and craziness that happens from that, isn't there? We see it in the world. That's why people get turned off by religion, because of that sort of fundamentalism. Only this is right. Nothing else is true. So that's the wrong way to go. That's attachment. But if you have no structure, no intellectual structure, you can kind of be awash with different traditions. Once you have one structure, like for me, Theravada, and you understand that, then you can use that to reflect off. Like I can reflect off maybe what Rumi's saying, not that I necessarily understand it, or what Advaita Vedanta says, or what maybe Thomas Merton says. I can reflect off of that and say, oh, okay, where is his language taking him in this? Oftentimes I don't understand. Like I read a lot of Thomas Merton. I loved it, but I didn't have a clue what he's talking about oftentimes. But I loved it. I loved the language. I loved his inspiration. But I had a structure that I could consider it through. Not as an in opposition. No. I have a structure from which I can consider. Okay, where are you going with your language now? And or Tibetan Buddhism or whatever. So that's very helpful. And I think if you have the kind of basic language around the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and then you diverge within that area, then you've got a really, really, really good structure. But again, I don't, someone asked if I would teach that. I don't have it. I don't have the memory for it anymore. And I think I am then. Afterwards, I realized that I'm a much more oral person and I had the gift of great teachers, so that's been important for me. But then there was a question around a dependent origination, so maybe I could try to remember what the heck that was about and see where we go. But so this is one of the first teachings that Venerable Nyanasuchi tried to help me with, because it seems so big. But I'll try to keep it simple. So basically, dependent origination is about conditionality, cause and effect. And it comes from what they call itta pachayata, which is just a simple formula of causality. With this, there is that. When there is not this, there is not that. Very simple. This being that comes to be. Without this, there is not that. So with the light switch on, there is light. The light switch off, there's not light. Simple causality. You could extend that causality with the power grid on and the light switch on and the light bulb functioning or being whole, there is light. Or you could extend that, you could say with the power grid on, light switch on, lamp okay, glasses on, text in front of me, there is reading. And you could extend that and a cup of coffee, there's better reading. Or boredom, there is no reading and there is no concentration. So dependent origination is just the way nature is functioning. That's just the function of nature. And it's all around us all the time. So the particular instance of this, which is important in the Buddhist teaching, is that what's the causality of suffering? Why? How does it arise and how does it cease? And so in the formulation, the complex formulation of 12 parts, it's really one whole model. But what's important in it is, first of all, the word avijja. Avijja pachaya sankara, with ignorance as condition, there are formations. And the word ignorance, it isn't like you don't know how to add or something like that. It's not that kind of rational lack of education, but I think Ajahn Sumedho's phrase, taking it personally, would be the best way to look at avijja. So let's say I I'm 85 years old today, and I'm a grandfather, and I've got two kids and four grandkids. It's my birthday, and I'm locked up in some place, and I can't see my family, and I'm hoping that they'll phone me. And I'm really hoping they'll phone me. And I'm all day I'm hoping they and they don't phone me. They forget to phone me, and I feel terribly disappointed. So my disappointment is dependently originated on all that which came before, right? Natural. But then the disappointment, then if I attach to it, and this is where the word attachment comes up, if I attach to it, I think about it in terms of selfing. They don't love me anymore. Maybe they had an accident. It's not fair. I sent them so many presents last year. They're old enough to write to me. The mind would start spinning out with self-thought, and that's what we mean by attachment. And that's when you, in that formulation, you see this idea of bhava and jati, rebirth. So with the conditionality of this experience, I'm a sensitive person, I'm expecting something, I feel this disappointment rises in me because I'm an emotional being. And then the craving not to have that. I don't want this feeling of disappointment, which has been conditioned by my expectations. But because I don't see that causality, I jump into it with self-view and I run with it, and there is rebirth. So that's one way we think of rebirth. A rebirth of a person in thought, in emotion, that then runs for the next day or two or three. And then maybe, finally, they phone and they say, wow, we had a terrible accident. The house burned down. And then, because I've hated them for 2 days, now I start to feel guilty, right? So with with disappointment as condition, there is anger. And blah, 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 all that thought. And then that thought runs out, and then there's a phone call. Oh, it's terrible. We had a fire, lost the house. And then with that as contact, that language, there is the feeling of, oh, I'm a terrible grandfather, bad, bad grandfather. And I run with that, with guilt, and hate myself. And you can see how that can run for many, many lifetimes, if you see what I mean by birth. Now, where that takes place outside of this particular incarnation, I don't know. There are reports that there's a rebirth. But for sure, I can understand what it's pointing to, that this is suffering of this birth of a human being who is now really suffering. And what's the way out? Well, the way out is first and foremost to not take it personally, to see disappointment as a natural phenomena which has arisen because of expectation. It's a chain of causality in nature, and that's very hard to do. Very, very hard to do. Right? So in some instances, you can see that more easily. And in those instances, you begin to see, well, this birth of a sense of a person is actually an object. And you watch that in meditation. You can see the regret I have about doing something last week, or the resentment I feel of what someone did to me, or my worries about the future. They're worries, they're resentments, but they're more than that if the sense of self gets all wrapped up in them and they run with thought. And that's rebirth, we'd say. Bhava and jati. And that's the cause of suffering. So the first step in breaking that cycle of birth and death, is to just see feeling as feeling, contact as contact, craving as craving, and not go to the attachment, which is very hard. Which is very, very hard to do, isn't it? And here we are, doing hard work. But you can see that in some instances, you can be like someone, let's say, maybe a child says to you innocently, I hate your grandpa. And you know darn well, I mean, it hurts maybe. I mean, I don't have a grandfather, but I mean, I imagine it would really hurt. But you're mature enough to know, oh, that's just going through me. You don't believe in it. Oh, that's just a child. it goes through you and it doesn't lodge there as any kind of a self. You just, that was painful. Maybe talk to the kid about it, but whatever. It just kind of, but doesn't lodge in there with thought. Doesn't get all kind of stuck in there. Well, it's a terrible child, never going to talk to it again, and so on and so forth. You see, sometimes you can do that, can't you? And those are the times of wisdom where there is contact, right? Because we are sensitive beings. And there's a feeling from contact, whether an emotional or environmental or whatever. And from that contact, there is pleasant and unpleasant. This is part of the ball game, unfortunately or fortunately. But contact and the tone of our life is plus and minus, good and bad, pleasant and unpleasant. And so the Buddha's saying, if you're just looking for pleasant feelings, you're in trouble, right? Because it just does not work that way. So that's one thing. You start to move towards equanimity and peacefulness and not just ride the waves of pleasant and unpleasant. You grow up, right? In that way. But there's actually a bigger issue in this than just that, because we're all doing that. The Buddha realizes, well, there is something that's not part of that birth-death paradigm. There is something which is unborn. As soon as you say the word thing, then it sounds like a thing you have to find. So language gets very difficult here. But his realization of the unconditioned, uncreated, unoriginated, unborn, the deathless peace, the harbor, the island, all those words, is that like a trick question I ask Buddhists, everything changes, right? And they said, yes, yes, Bhante. No, you lose. No chocolate for you. Because Nibbana is not about change. And that's why it is a spiritual dimension. And that's why dependent origination is very, very important. Not in a just in a kind of trivial sense. You know, like in a trivial sense, the last 2 days I haven't eaten much because I wasn't hungry, but I've had a fair bit of coffee. You know, so last night I was absolutely wired. I was really wired. I said, Viridhammo, stop this. And so that's a trivial example of dependent origination, you know, this with no food in stomach, but coffee in stomach, there is this result of energy. But that's trivial. That's not what it's about, really. What it's about more, and we all know that already, otherwise we wouldn't survive on the planet. But what's more important is that, and conditionality, one of the words we use is sankata. It's compounded, or Venerable Tanisaros, he says it's fabricated, it's built, it's made up of stuff, right? And there's the unfabricated or uncreated or unconditioned. It's not built of things, it's not dependent on things. And this is very mysterious, a very hard language to talk about. But the point of the Buddha's realization is not just a trivial example of conditionality, but to realize the unconditioned. That's the project. And so then the logic is, if you're trying to find peace in that which is conditioned, you'll always be disappointed. If you're trying to find why your roses aren't surviving and it's aphids, yeah, you'll find it for sure. So it's not that conditionality isn't important. It is important. But what we're trying to discover is the asankata. So you have sankata and asankata. It's negation of sankata, and that's the unconditioned. Now, if you understand that, and you understand the nature of relative truth and conventional truth and societal responsibility, you do that according to conditionality. You'll create the conditions which are most suitable for your well-being and the being of others. So that's when you use it there. But then your spiritual practice is at the level of non-grasping. So then I'm the grandfather, and I feel this pain of disappointment. Now, I was actually thinking about grandfathers and grandmothers, because I see a lot of white hair out there and gray hair. And I reckon you people out there probably have maybe grandkids. And I wonder if those grandkids know how cool you are. Yeah? I mean, you're really cool. You're sitting for 45 minutes. And you're not that young, but anyway. That's why the image of grandparents came up for me. So the grandfather feels a disappointment, right? But now he's a little cool grandfather. And he now realizes that it's painful, but there is a way now to not get reborn as a disappointed grandfather. And so bears witness to the changing nature of an unpleasant feeling, and he bears witness to unfulfilled desire. Because his desires is to not have this, but it's there. So it goes right into the burning of the heart and witnesses this pain. But it's like this, it's changing. It's painful, I welcome it. And he begins to see the cessation of wanting, the cessation of craving. And that's one of the ways we talk about the unconditioned. It's realized through the cessation of this mind always going out into objects, into the objective world. And then they phone 2 days later and he gives a good response. Or he has more chance of it, right? So it's not a very complex teaching, and yet it can be formulated very complex. But I think the nub of it for me has always been, why did the Buddha teach? And he taught because he had this realization. And what does that mean in my own search for freedom and my own social life? So my own social life lives in dependently originated circumstances. It can't be any other way. But then my curiosity is, what's unconditioned, right? I know a lot of people get turned on by that language, but there you go. That's Theravada Buddhism. We don't use God. Advaita Vedanta uses the big self. We don't use that either. So you kind of have to read where, like Rumi uses something else, or love maybe. So you have to see, where is that in literature? It is in literature. But in any case, then if that's what I'm curious about, then I can see that, my desires to have the sense experience to be a certain way is the problem if I don't see the desire. But if I see the desire as just an object and I remain as witness, it arises and ceases, I begin to realize the third noble truth. The cessation of craving is the realization of Nibbana, the peace of the mind which isn't contingent and dependent on conditioned phenomena. So you have both. You have both operating, right? How could it be otherwise? This body is dependently originated, and it will die. Like the Buddhist joke, like, why am I sick? Well, because you were born. Thanks. But that's the ultimate medical condition. And it's true. But it's also true that maybe I can do something about my sickness before I die and so on. So that's where dependent origination. But is that all there is? You know, this is the Buddha saying, is that all there is? Is this just this birth and death cycle that we're in? Is there something more? And he says there is something more, a spiritual dimension. So I hope that's helpful. But I thought I could then segue into some of those questions from that. While doing sitting meditation, I experience a lot of muscle tension around the face, neck, shoulders, upper back. It's kind of like I'm trying too hard not to move, trying to, and so on and so on. Any suggestions around how to release that tension? I'm currently working with the words non-becoming and non-resistance whenever I notice the tension or the thoughts around it. They're very common, really. One of the ways, of course, to do yoga nidra, go for the seal. But and that's very interesting, because then, you know, you don't have to hold the body up. So if you want to just, you know, like, contrast is good, right? And if you could contrast the lying posture and do it when you've got lots of energy. Don't do it as a antidote for falling asleep, because that's not what you're trying to do. Do it when you have lots of energy and do that posture and the sitting posture and see, okay, is there the tension there? What's going on? And then do the sitting. And contrast is good that way. You just see what's going on. But the quite often what arises in meditation is the desire to fix. So any, you know, you kind of just get sort of caught up with trying to fix the posture and trying to fix the tension and fix that. And that whole fixing part of it is a kind of desire, right? And so somehow you have to just leave it alone. And one of the ways is whole body awareness, I would say. So in that one meditation I did where I suggested, you know the mouth, know the eyes, and see them in awareness, and get that sense that awareness is outside the body, or the body is in awareness, that kind of thing. That can be helpful. But I think the best is really like change, you know, get two postures going and see what happens. What's the difference as a kind of curious thing? Another thing in meditation, if it's not going well, just go up and have a biscuit. Like just change the whole program. You know, chocolate chip biscuit, that's what I need right now. That'll really get my meditation going well. And it's true, because you just kind of just forget about meditation. It's the same like craft. If I'm working in the workshop and it's just not going, I know, get out of there. Go for a walk, or you know, talk to the deer, or you know, whatever, do something different. And then come back and see, okay, what's happening now? And like walking away from things can be, you know, very skillful. When you come back, you have a contrast. Contrast is good. But there can be this desire to fix it. So then you do things like, fine, pain, you can stay there for the next 10 days. You know, you're going to, you know, that kind of give it a cup of tea language, maybe that. Or you ask yourself, what's the desire here? Where's the desire here? So you get to the Four Noble Truths. What's the desire feel like, rather than the pain or the tension or whatever it might be? So it's a kind of inquiring into, rather than like just trying to let go. Konaifa can be coming from desire, and then that's the sign, okay, what do I want here? Where's wanting here? And then you wait and see if you can observe that. So it's not uncommon. But the inquiry then like teaches you. But the lying posture can be very interesting that way. So if you take dependent origination then what is the real suffering here? Is it the pain or constriction or tension, or is it the not wanting? Is it the not wanting of that and wanting something else? So then you take, you know, that suffering is dependently originated upon attachment to desire. And so you look at that and say, okay, what is it? So you always go back to the Four Noble Truths as your basic go-to contemplative tool. What do I want here? And then that gives you some insight around that. And if it's too tough, walk away, come down, you know, try it again. So the inquiry through Four Noble Truths is really fruitful around these kinds of constants that we get. Another one, as a young child, the seeds of doubt were baked into my consciousness from my parents. You should be a doctor, you should be more like your brother, you should be this or that. When meditating, I can see the ocean's waves from the shore and observe doubt as doubt. Yet off the cushion, it seems to be my nagging in the shadow's companion. Your boss is irritated at you, da-da-da-da-da. You should do this, you should do that. From your experiences with dealing with doubt, I'd love to know how you learn to work with it outside of formal practice. It's certainly my biggest hindrance. It's not uncommon, again. I guess for me, my problem was in fear. And so I would ask this person, is there underlying fear? And to just inquire, what's the kind of underlying energy that's there? Quite often, these things are grounded in fear. Fear is a really huge, huge part of our psyche. And then there are the overlays of that, of personality to deal with the fear and be a human being in society in the way one's been conditioned. So if you can kind of get back to, first of all, whenever you feel any fear, get to know it bodily. Say, great, okay, even if it's like like I think my friend, he lives and there are bears where he lives. So now I'm not suggesting get on the porch and hug the bear. This is probably not a good idea. But, you know, just the fear of a bear or whatever kind of fear you have, get to know, oh, this is fear, good. Where is it in the body? And you get very good at recognizing fear as a bodily function. And then when these self, I should come up, can you see, is there a bodily component to that? Is it a familiar component? And if you get good at that in situations which aren't too demanding, then little by little, you get some light in those more demanding and constricted situations. So you always work, obviously, where you can work. And you kind of develop the awareness in the non-complex parts of your life. And then you bring it in naturally into the complex parts. But I would say that it's quite often not a problem of doubt. Doubt more for me, it can feel like that, but doubt for me is like more intellectual. Right? Like, oh, what is really emptiness in Theravada Buddhism? So the thinking mind analyzing and always sort of trying to get the right answer, never getting an answer that's good enough, and then thinking again, another doubt. Whereas this, I would, you know, you have to see if I'm accurate or if the, you know, if the hat fits, wear it kind of thing. But perhaps this is more like the problem of fear that's been conditioned societally, familiarly, and now it manifests. So you get really good at body awareness, really, really good, really good at heart chakra, really good at just like a kind of, you know, you can multitask, right? You can do two things at once, or three or four or five. So you can multitask in terms of awareness. You can be aware that you're talking with someone who's kind of you're really anxious with. And you can be aware of the anxiety in your body. You can do both, can't you? And that's what you want to do. You want to get this kind of second level awareness going around bodily feeling, in your guts, in your heart, anywhere, so that when you enter into complexity, you've always got that going. You've always got that going. You're knowing that. And then any constrictions there become really obvious, and you're staying there. Even though you're in the social situation, you're staying there, you're staying with it, getting to know it. And then that's non-attachment, right? Because you're not believing in the thought patterns. So if thought patterns come up, oh, I'm inadequate, I'm no good, say, oh, this is what inadequacy feels like. Come back to that line and then hold it in the body. But don't expect it just to run away. Good luck. It doesn't work that way. It's more like you're just entering into the aura and feeling of inadequacy or self-doubt or whatever. Just get really, really good at that. And then that is the work. Because you're not proliferating on that, and then you have to be patient. And if it got conditioned in over 20 formative years of your life, it's a long haul to slowly liberate that from consciousness. It's very, very hard. So also be very kind to yourself. And say to yourself, this is not easy work. Rather, that it does take a lot of kind of compassion and patience. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot. And I always look at it like if someone else was suffering like that, would I not have compassion for that? So I would. And so the heart kind of becomes more gentle towards it. Would you please talk about preparing to die, supporting one at the end stages of life, and the helpful Buddhist practices and chants and Theravada rituals around care of the body and after? I've had the last few years, several women who are friends of the monastery have come to me and they're in terminal stages of cancer and they ask me, okay, I'm on palliative care now, how do I do dying? It's not your usual question, right? How do I do dying? So, okay. Right away I asked them, well, what do you think consciousness is? Do you think consciousness is gets snuffed out with the death of the body? So do you think consciousness is a material element, or is it something that is not a material element? So I don't use the word rebirth, because that can, I just asked like consciousness itself. And all of these women, I said, no, I don't think consciousness is a physical phenomenon. So that's helpful, okay? So like if a person thinks that the body dies and consciousness is also contingent on the body, yeah, and that it's a black hole or whatever, then I would work with a sense of whatever goodness that has manifested in their life to dwell on that. What the good works they've done or the loving relationships they had. But if the person then has this other perspective, the consciousness is a wider dimension than just this physical body, then it's a very interesting discussion. Then you could ask, well, what do you think happens to consciousness at the death of the body? And then we all say, beats me. Don't know. And I say, well, what would be the best way to explore that when you're dying? Right? Mindfulness, awareness. So, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Awareness, if there's anything that is going to somehow be a part of consciousness, it's got to be awareness. That's the only thing it can be. And you kind of, you know, you talk a person through that. And if they see that, they say, so what could you do to prepare for death? Would it not be awareness now? And yeah, of course. So if you start to feel fear or pain, what would you do to prepare for death? You'd be aware of pain and fear as an object. Oh, okay. So you can like talk a person, but it really depends on where their philosophy is at. If they're profoundly Christian and their model is of God in heaven, then you'd have to use that language, you know, to help. So the first thing is always listening and understanding the philosophical or religious background of the person, and then not arguing it, but thinking, okay, how can I, using that model of consciousness and birth and death and so on, with this person, how can I make them happy or at ease or content or curious or whatever it is? So it's always listening and understanding the model that they're coming from, and maybe persuading them to a different model, but not to convert them. My gosh, no, please. That's horrible. That's a horrible thing to do, because that's oppressive. So you have to really go with the, like, I don't know this person. Even if you think you know them, because sometimes you don't know them around these issues, and then get a dialogue going so they trust you and you have a feeling for them. And then your own intuitions usually function well. Then in terms of death itself, and I've talked about this, when my mom died, I asked my brother to delay the mortician coming for, I think it was 36 hours, and because I really wanted to be with mom's body. And so when she died, I washed her body, and then some of our friends came and we did chanting. There were no monks around because they were all in the monastery. So there's some, like, I think Anoma was there, Priyani, and we did chanting, and I kind of, you know, got her all nice and clean and laid her out and all of that. And I had seen that done, so I understood how to do that. But that was obviously very, very powerful. But I didn't want someone else doing that. I wanted to do that. I wanted to be a part of this whole thing. And then I turned all the heat off. This is in March. And I opened the windows of her room. And then she was on her bed. And I would just sometimes sleep on the floor. And then I was organizing a funeral, so I go back and forth. And then after 36 hours, it's too much. I was so tired. And then I phoned my brother, and then they took her body away. So as a monk, obviously I had chants, I had rituals that I could do, I had reflections that I could do, which is really, really lovely. And I had an association of friends who could do that. And then, of course, all the ashes, right? Fine, medium, or coarse. And then, like, I just wanted to be a part of it as much as possible rather than think someone else should do that. So in terms of rituals, if you have someone who has had a history of Buddhist rituals, then you can use all of them. If they don't, well, it kind of depends, right? So I have found going to, what's the hospice, the Mary, anyway, the hospice in the Glebe in Ottawa, I've been there quite a few times, and people I know, meditators, and then I go in and I just do the chanting, and they have enough familiarity with it, either more or less, that it's incredibly calming. That's very interesting to watch, where I won't say much, really, because usually they're not that lucid in the last stages, but I'll just like bring a monk with good voice, and we'll just chant for like 10 minutes or so, and you just see the person relax, because the vibe or the association is one of, it's okay, this is peaceful, right? So it's very interesting how the tone, like if you have a history of chanting that always associates you with goodness, then obviously that's going to be an advantage when you're dying and you hear that chanting. You hear that, oh yeah, yeah, I remember that. And it's not going to be intellectual, it's going to be at a different level. So in Sri Lanka, Thailand probably too, they'll have recordings of the Paritta chants for people who are dying, and they just play them. A very soothing kind of thing. So you better learn your chanting so you're ready. But even if a person doesn't have that background, what I found going to hospice or hospital, quite often the people in the bed, next bed or next room, they like it too. Because somehow it feels wholesome, it feels good. It feels good in that way. There are no necessary rituals in Buddhism around the demise of a person, because what we think is just the momentum of the person's life creates the next possibility, right? So it's more really for the living that these rituals are done. Cultures do get superstitious and they think, well, this ritual has to be done this way, but that's usually a function of fear, right? I think the ritual should be done beautifully. And so I've had some very interesting funerals in my day where I've been in situations quasi-Buddhist. The person was a Buddhist, not quite a Buddhist, and they invite me. And I know them quite well. And the most interesting one was in New Zealand. And there's I think the woman was a Malaysian background. And she's a very, very good artist. She belonged to a galamang, you know, the steel band, the kind of steel drum from Indonesia. Maybe she was Indonesian, I can't remember. So she was a part of that. She did Italian Renaissance dance. And she loved poetry. So this funeral was just fascinating that you had, I think her ex-partner read a poem, and her son read a poem, but we walked into the chapel with the galamang troupe playing their music. That was the introductory music. So we walked, and it was really her. It was lovely. And then, the two dancers danced this Italian Renaissance dance up and down the aisles. I gave my Buddhist bit, and we did some chanting, and we were over time by an hour. But the people around the place, they were just gaga. And I guess there was no one after us. So, you know, like a funeral doesn't have to be traditional. It can bring in all kinds of elements, really. But I think the most important part for me is obviously as a monk, is the reflective part. That there is the language of reflection in the service. You know, it's not just You know, this is, I find people don't want to talk about death. I've been to funerals. Well, let's not talk about death. Let's just have a celebration of this person's life. Yeah, but this is an opportunity. And that is sometimes I'm a bit, well, it's just the way it is. I can understand it. But to actually talk about death and consciousness and so on, I think is very, very important. So that, and in these times, with so much disruption, fear and pain, I believe that belonging to a Sangha is most important, but we cannot meet in person. So what are the qualities of a temporary and virtual Sangha, and how can we attain more of the benefit of the Sangha in Kalyanamitta without physical presence? Well, here we are. We're doing it. I think, you know, people who... What's a good... Like, a good friend is one who obviously raises your game, right? Your spiritual game, right? So someone... Like, if you're whinging about something and you go to another person and they allow you to whinge and complain and say, yeah, and they complain too, that's not a spiritual friend. That's an ally of stupidity. Right? And so, you know, to listen to someone whinging and then say, yeah, it's really, how does it feel to whinge? You make them more aware of their kind of moaning, complaining mind. That's more a Kalyanamitta, isn't it, right? So one who isn't afraid to say, you know, to bring Dhamma into a discussion and to bring personal responsibility into a discussion. This is very, very good. But not in a kind of sermonizing, you know, that's always also offensive when someone kind of just dismisses your concerns. So don't make it a problem, or it's all anicca anyway, you know, kind of Buddha speak. You don't want that too. But like, to listen in terms of Dharma means to listen, and then how can we take this to the liberation from suffering rather than the moaning about the world? So that would be good. So then, you know, what does one need as a Kalyanamitta? What do you need in terms of that? And then how can you define that in getting like-minded people? So for us, say, as monks, what we need is what we call Samana Sanya, which is the perception of a renunciant. And that's very powerful for us. When we see a monk who has the robe on and is living really diligently, that's a huge, you know, like it raises my game, right? But when we see a kind of sloppy monk who, you know, is really, really indulgent in speech, and they think, oh, come on, that's not a really Kalyanamitta. Hopefully we raise his game in some kind of way. So the signs of a spiritual life are like good morality and diligence and social responsibility and all of that, right speech and things like that. So that you walk away from a human relationship with a sense of being encouraged and inspired. Whereas if a group of people just get into a kind of moaning coffee session talking about, you know, the death of the planet or whatever, what's the point? Everyone's doing that anyway, right? So how can it always kind of move towards Dharma would be the thing. And then groups of study are good, where quite like a study, you know, like if you have a group of people who talk about money, I don't know about money. You got to figure out money. Maybe, you know, someone talks about how you use money or something like that, or kids, or education, or issues that monks don't know about. That's very, very important, because you have so much wisdom in a community. You know, you had so much experience, you have kids, and things that, like someone like me has no experience. I don't know what it means to be a parent, or to have a bank account, or whatever. And those are very important things to try to talk about in terms of Dharma. Huh? So there's a lot of room there. And then support in times of need, so that, you know, if you have a group of people and say, hey, you know, well, she's got cancer, she got kids too, okay, yeah, let's take her enough food to put in the freezer for the next week, And that's Kalyanamitta, right? Ringing up, say, how are you doing? That's okay too, but you know, like pragmatic stuff, and helping people out. Because in times of need, we really need friends. We need friends in whatever ways they might be. All right. Still have 15 minutes in my time slot here. I often hear, that person does not deserve your compassion, especially respect to public figures who may be immoral or cruel. But the Buddha taught compassion for all beings, and I try to offer metta to all in my heart and through action. But can we offer compassion for beings while simultaneously disliking those beings or their behavior? And what are the implications if we withhold metta or karuna because of that dislike? Well, again, I don't look at metta and the Brahma-viharas as something that I launch forth to some people and not to other people. I don't perceive that teaching in that way. I perceive it more as an energy system within me that when it's whole and functioning without the interruptions of egotism and so on, that it's always open and available, right? And if it closes down with hatred, I know that's to my detriment and the detriment of those close to me. Now, the other, the critical commentary about foolish and dangerous people is another part of my life. That's the political social part of my life, and that's the social justice part of my life, and that, and so on and so forth. And in that realm, I can very strongly say I totally think that's wrong. So if I was in Europe in the 30s, you know, you had Spain, fascists in Spain, and Italy, Germany, Eastern Europe, fascism was just rampant, right? I wouldn't just say, oh, may they all be well and happy, right? But I know darn well that if I just hated all of that, then that would not make me a good functioning person within myself. So it's really not, but if you conceive of metta bhavana as something that you send out to Joe Bloggs out here, but Sam over here, you withhold it. It doesn't compute for me. It doesn't work that way. Is the heart open or closed? And if it's open and it's closing, do I really want to go there? Do I want to occupy my bandwidth with hatred? Right? No, I don't. I don't want to do that. But that doesn't mean I approve or condone the foolishness in the world. And if I have some power, then I have to act with that power. To really protect your mind from following hatred, to me just seems a logical kind of thing. So the most minimum practice of metta bhavana is not dwelling in aversion. Doesn't mean that you like or even love a person. It's not dwelling in aversion is the sort of minimum criteria. And that's very important. That's very important, even though that it might seem justified. And so, as human beings, we have models of that. We have the Dalai Lama. His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We have Nelson Mandela. We have Dr. King. You know, we have. But beautiful, beautiful people who really, really rose to the occasion, like Nelson Mandela. He refused to hate the people who imprisoned him, but he worked politically very, very hard. His Holiness Dalai Lama refused to hate the Chinese. I once saw a program in New Zealand, or someone told me, I think I saw it. It was an interviewer in New Zealand television. He told me this was visiting New Zealand. And the interview is a very, very acidic kind of attacking, kind of one of those horrible interviewers. And I don't know how they put His Holiness on there, but he said, like, this guy said to His Holiness, so do you hate the Chinese? In a kind of Kiwi accent. And His Holiness said, no. And this guy said, I don't believe you. And His Holiness just laughed. You can see he was sincere. He was sincere. But he wasn't naive. He's not naive politically. And he's very active in his own community. So that is possible. So if you see it's not about, you know, others. It's really about my heart. And obviously, if I'm perpetuating any amount of aversion to others, then that's got to somehow going to come back in my family. At some point, it'll get triggered. You know, there's a price to pay. But to call evil evil is correct. You have to do that. To say, no, that's wrong. You cannot do that. That's correct to say, isn't it? So it's not sort of a, oh, yes, I'm a doormat. Please walk all over me. I love you. It's not that. It's strong. You think about the Dalai Lama and Nelson Mandela. They're strong people, weren't they? Or Dr. King or whatever. They're very strong people. Not sentimental. A kind of a beautiful strength. So there's the kind of social. And in Buddhism, we say there's the conventional reality and there's this transcendent heart, and both are important. Both are important. Someone asks, can I use my tinnitus or tinnitus as a nada practice? So I don't really know. That's the kind of talk we have. And it seems to me, from the little I know about it, that tinnitus can be of varying degrees of intensity. And is that nada? I don't know. But I would say to the person, be careful. If you've got a way of being at ease with that tinnitus, then stay with that rather than muck about with that. Because that, you know, after a few years, you figure it out how to be at peace with it. That's important. I have read a little bit about that where you know, in a blog where someone will say, well, it's the sound of God, nada, and I use my tinnitus as nada and the sound of God. And then there's a response, yeah, but I can't even hear, I hear my kids crying, I go crazy. So, you know, there seems to be quite a variance in what the intensity of that is. But my intuition here is just be careful. You know, if you've got a way of accommodating that, then just be with that. That seems, but I really don't know, I'm not sure. Finally, I have 8 minutes. Fear and even panic has been arising in my practice, as well as unexplained pain in the body. This arose after months of tranquility. I have been allowing it and sensing into the peace around it. Anything you could say about this way of practicing would be helpful. Well, I would first of all get a good physical. You know, you never know. You know, maybe a tick has bitten you or something. You never know. So get a good physical, you know, get the blood checked and all that. Make sure that system is okay. And then having done that, if you can find a doctor and get all that. Then I would say you probably have enough experience to witness this and make it, I guess I would say, make it a challenge of getting to know fear and panic and the desire around it. So with fear and panic, the problem is the desire not to have fear and panic. So it seems counterintuitive to welcome them, right? But don't, without putting yourself into dangerous situations, welcome fear and panic. Very hard to do. But you can see how the logic of that is the desire is to say, God, I don't want this. This is bad news. And yet you've got enough experience if you've had trinkets. Oh, okay. This is tough. But can I abide as a witness to this now and see what's the desire? That's what you have to look at with fear. Not the energy of fear itself, it's the desire not to have the fear. Once you sort of get a handle of that, then you say, oh, yeah, it's about welcoming. And that's where metta bhavana comes in. Metta bhavana or compassion is the allowing of fear to be an object in awareness. Thought then will spin you out. See, how can you not go to the thoughts, go to the body, and look at craving to get rid of it and say, it's okay, you can come and stay all day. Hard to do, to navigate that. But oftentimes when people have a kind of extreme changes. I mean, get a blood test. You know, check it out on all levels, because who knows how these things work. Okay, that's it. Thank you for all those questions. That's very, very helpful. So I think we could, do we want to do anything else? Lynn, did you want to make an acknowledgement?
Yes, Ajahn, we would like to acknowledge the teachings and express our appreciation. Handamayang Dhammakataya, Sadhu Karanga Dhammase,
Sadhu, 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 Anumodami.
Well done, Lynn. Okay, let's finish with the Metta Sutta. This is what should be done one time. You have the text, everyone? This is what should be done
by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.